Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder, and it's time to go back into the classroom as we learn American English. First, Jill Robbins joins us. It's a great lesson. Then you can use what you have just learned as we tell you about new scientific research that may be of help to injured soldiers. So let's get started. Here's Jill.
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Today, we're going to talk about using the subjunctive. English speakers use the subjunctive to express a wide variety of unreal or possible situations. Today, we will only focus on how to use the subjunctive with a noun clause to express urgency or importance. For example, I suggest that you arrive early. The subjunctive offers speakers a polite and diplomatic way to tell someone to do something or stress that something is very important. It is a useful alternative to a direct command. A mother might tell a child, "Stop eating with your hands." How can we be polite and stress urgency at the same time? We suggest that you use the subjunctive. Instead of the direct command, "Stop eating with your hands," you could say, "It is important that you eat with a fork." Imagine you are a supervisor. You want your employee to stop being late for work. You could say, "Come to work on time." But a more polite way would be to use the subjunctive. "It is very important that you come to work on time." Or, "It is essential that you manage your time more efficiently." In most situations, the speaker using the subjunctive has power over the listener. In our examples, the mother has power over the child. The boss has power over the employee. There are two common structures for the subjunctive. The first one uses a verb followed by that, followed by the object, followed by the simple form of the verb. For example, his father demanded that he join the army. In this example, demanded is the verb. That marks the beginning of the noun clause. He is the object, and join is the subjunctive verb. That is optional. You could also say, "His father demanded he join the army." The most common verbs that are followed by the subjunctive are advise, ask, propose, suggest, request, and insist. Listen for the subjunctive in this conversation between cartoon characters Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. In this scene, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck come across Elmer Fudd, a hunter who is looking for rabbits.
"It's true, Doc. I'm a rabbit, all right. Would you like to shoot me now or wait till you get home?"
"Shoot him now! Shoot him now!"
"You keep out of this. He doesn't have to shoot you now."
"He just so have to shoot me now. I demand that you shoot me now."
The subjunctive sentence in the dialogue is, "I demand that you shoot me now." Daffy Duck meant to say, "I demand that you shoot him now. Him referring to Bugs Bunny. Listen again.
It's true, Doc. I'm a rabbit, all right. Would you like to shoot me now or wait till you get home?
Shoot him now! Shoot him now!
You keep out of this. He doesn't have to shoot you now.
He does so have to shoot me now. I demand that you shoot me now.
The second form of the subjunctive uses it is followed by an adjective, followed by that, followed by the simple form of the verb. For example, it is vital that he take his medicine. Remember, there is no third person S in the subjunctive. Don't say, it is vital that he takes his medicine. Fortunately, there are only a few adjectives that are used in this form of the subjunctive. Here are some examples. It is essential that you bring your wallet. It is imperative that you read the instructions. It is important that she arrive on time. It is necessary that she book the ticket in advance. Politicians love to use the subjunctive because it gives a serious and authoritative tone to what they are saying. Listen to presidential candidate Marco Rubio using the subjunctive in a recent speech.
And I just think it's critically important that the next president of the United States be someone that understands the 21st century and has ideas that will make America, allow America to fulfill its potential.
A good way to practice the subjunctive is to listen to political speeches in English. You are likely to hear both of the forms that we discussed today. There are many other ways that English speakers use the subjunctive. We covered some of them in our episodes on conditionals and advanced conditionals. Another common use is to express wishes, as we showed in our episode on modals of certainty and hope. Until next time, remember, it is important that you learn the subjunctive. For Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Scientists have been studying the effect of explosions on soldiers' brains since World War I. Some military veterans who survived powerful explosions may become violent or experience depression. It may be difficult for the former soldiers to concentrate on what they are doing. Their feelings may change quickly, from happy to sad or even angry. Now, researchers have found that the soldiers' brains suffered physical damage, like people who die in transportation accidents or from a drug overdose. Bob Doty tells us more.
Researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine examined the brains of former soldiers who had died. These veterans had been injured in a battlefield explosion, but it was not what caused their death. The researchers discovered evidence that nerve fibers in the front of the brain had been damaged. Professor Vasily Koliatsos led the study. He says the discovery explains why the veterans had a condition known as shell shock.
And that's very important because this is the site, this is the center of the executive functions of the brain, functions that allow you to put your life together, organize, plan ahead, understand, abstract. And you can imagine that this can make your life difficult.
Professor Koliatso says the physical damage was often found near blood vessels inside the skull. He says this suggests that the force of the explosion pushed blood from the chest into the brain. This caused the brain to quickly swell or become enlarged. He says when the brain swells, it pushes against the skull. The professor says that, as a result of the study's findings, doctors may decide to give different medicines to veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he says the findings may cause military officials to find ways to better protect a soldier's chest. I'm Bob Doty.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A group of 50 Cambodian schoolchildren are trying a program to develop young people who can improve the country. They are working to develop a model program that can be repeated in other countries. In 2012, teachers and staff from the Liger Learning Center interviewed hundreds of children across Cambodia. They wanted to find the most promising students. They chose 25 boys and 25 girls. The Liger Learning Center paid for all of the students' education and living costs. Most of Liger's 50 students are from poor families. Cambodia has a weak public education system. Children of low-earning families have little chance to receive a quality education. The Liger School wants to change that for these 50 students. Next year, they want to add 50 more students. Over time, they want to change education for the whole country. U.S. businessman Trevor Guile, who started the school with his wife, was in Cambodia last week. He said that the goal of the school is to help people help themselves instead of just giving them money. That means those who attend the school have to give something back. Education in Cambodia is slowly improving. But the education minister has a very big job ahead. Teaching methods at government schools are based on rote learning, memorization of subjects in order to pass exams. Mr. Guile's wealth means that Liger is ahead of other schools. Each Liger student, for instance, has a laptop. The school uses a more modern teaching style. Students often do group projects and take class trips. 13-year-old Seha was chosen. His parents, who have very little money, were happy. Seha worked with a team of Liger students to write a book about Cambodia's wildlife. Another book the Liger students wrote about the economy will be used in schools across the country. Trevor Guile says, in the end, the Liger Learning Center is about more than helping Cambodia to move forward. Mr. Guile is happy with the progress so far. He says he is sure Liger will show the results it promises. Then, he says, other individuals and organizations will want to expand the idea. Trevor Guile expects that by 2025, there will be at least 10 Liger schools in the region and beyond. By then, this class of 12 and 13-year-olds will have graduated. If all goes as planned, they will be using the skills they are learning here to help Cambodia move forward. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. We have been talking about the Compromise of 1850. In September of that year, the United States Congress passed five bills that sought to settle the issue of slavery. All five became law after the president signed them.
Yes, I love everybody. No evil have I done.
Owning another human being was legal in many parts of the U.S. at that time. Most American slaves or their ancestors originally came from Africa. Many slaves worked for white landowners in cotton or tobacco fields. Some, like Phoebe Boyd of Virginia, worked in the family's home.
Had to clean up and set the table, put in the eating.
That recording comes from the Voices from the Days of Slavery project at the U.S. Library of Congress. Ms. Boyd was speaking in 1935, remembering her childhood as a slave. She said she had to clean up, set the table, carry the food, and afterwards prepare the bed. Harriet Smith of Texas was another former slave. She said in a 1941 recording that she did not go to school.
They know nothing about reading and writing. All that I know, the teachers of mine, your master and your missus.
Aunt Harriet, as she was called, said she did not know anything about reading or writing. She said she was taught only to obey the slave owners. Slaves were considered property, like farm animals or furniture. Slave owners could do anything they wanted with their slaves, including separate them from their families, sexually abuse them, hurt, or even kill them. Harriet Smith said her owners treated her well, but she heard about slaves who were mistreated.
Yes, I know times of mistreated people that did. I hear our folks talking about them hooping, so they had to grease the back to take the clothes from the back.
Some slaves were beaten so badly, she said, they had to repair the holes in their backs with grease. By 1804, all northern states had banned slavery. But northern whites still did not accept blacks as their equals. And slavery was still legal in southern states for more than half of the 19th century. Slave owners there said they needed slaves to work on large farms or for other economic reasons. But other Americans said slavery was immoral, or that it gave the South the unfair competitive edge of low-cost labor. The Compromise of 1850 attempted to balance the desires of those who supported and those who opposed slavery. Politicians were not the only ones who struggled with the issue of slavery in the United States. Slaves, for example, had been fighting the system for some time. Many slaves resisted their owners in small ways. They broke or hid tools, or they worked slowly or claimed to be sick even when they were not. A few answered the violence of slavery with violence. They planned, but rarely succeeded, to kill their masters and escape. A man named Nat Turner led one of the best-known slave rebellions. Turner was born in 1800 in the slave state of Virginia. Unlike most slaves, he could read. He also believed that God had given him a special purpose. In 1831, Turner saw what he described as a sign from above. The sign told him it was time to rebel against slavery. He gathered several men and, in the middle of the night, killed his master and his master's family in their beds. Turner and his men continued to another house and then another. They killed every white person they found. Other slaves saw what was happening and joined Turner. By the end of the raids, 40 blacks had stabbed, beaten, or shot to death an estimated 55 whites. A local white militia moved to stop Turner and his group. Almost all the attackers were captured quickly. Some were killed, others were sold and sent away from their families. But Nat Turner escaped capture. For a month, he hid around his master's farm. Finally, someone found him. Turner was jailed, tried, sentenced, and hanged. After he died, his killers pulled off his skin and removed his head. The historian Henry Louis Gates, Jr. studied Nat Turner's slave rebellion. He wrote that blacks remembered Turner for his personal war against slavery, his violent methods, and his harsh treatment after death. But whites had a different reaction. Frightened white mobs killed another 200 blacks to answer the rebellion. Most of these blacks had no part in the rebellion. After Nat Turner's rebellion, the state of Virginia passed stronger laws to control slaves. The legislation included bans on reading, gathering, and traveling. Even with stronger laws in place, many slaves continued taking huge risks in an effort to win their freedom. From about the end of the 1700s to the middle of the 1800s, thousands escaped slavery on what came to be called the Underground Railroad.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls.
The Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. It was a group of people, both blacks and whites, who secretly helped slaves escape to the North.
Follow the drink and gold.
Members of the Underground Railroad helped slaves leave the places where they lived and worked. These conductors took the escaping slaves to a safe house or business called a station. Station masters hid the escaped slave. Then, at night, a different conductor took him or her to another hiding place farther north. The process was repeated every day and night until the escaped slave was safe in a free state, or even in Canada. A black woman named Harriet Tubman was perhaps the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. She had been born a slave around 1820. She worked first in a house and then in the fields for an owner in the slave state of Maryland. Harriet Tubman was known for her bravery. One story people told about her happened when she was a teenage girl. An overseer, someone who controlled the slaves in the field, became angry with another slave. He threatened the man with a heavy weight. Young Harriet stepped between the overseer and the other slave. The overseer threw the weight. It hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, Harriet Tubman suffered from the injury. It caused headaches, strange dreams, and, from time to time, made her fall deeply asleep. When Tubman was about 29, she suspected her owner would sell her, so she decided to escape instead. One night, she secretly walked away. She walked over 200 kilometers, following the North Star. Eventually, she arrived in the city of Philadelphia, in the free state of Pennsylvania. A year later, Tubman returned to Maryland. She helped her sister and her sister's children escape. Then she helped her brother and two other men. She helped her parents, who were over 70 years old, and she helped many others. In all, Tubman made as many as 19 trips to the South. She led about 300 slaves to freedom. Tubman and her passengers were never caught, but if they had been, they would have been severely punished. Former masters were likely to beat or cut off the hands of escaped slaves. The Compromise of 1850 made escaping slavery even harder. One of the bills Congress passed was the Fugitive Slave Act. It said anyone who helped a fugitive, that is, an escaped slave, would be fined. And it said fugitive slaves must be returned to their owner, even if they had escaped to a free state. Fugitive slaves had no right to a trial. Because they could not defend themselves in court, even freed blacks could be kidnapped and enslaved. In 1852, a white woman published a book about slavery. She called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote the book for one reason. She wanted to show how cruel slavery was. Fugitive slaves also published books about their experiences. The stories painted a picture of slavery that most people in the North had never seen. They were shocked. Public pressure to end slavery grew stronger. Anti-slavery activists, called abolitionists, wanted to free all slaves immediately. But even if that could be done, there was the question of what to do with the freed slaves. In many places, it seemed impossible that blacks and whites could live together peacefully and in freedom. The best answer, some people thought, was to free the slaves and help them return to Africa. It was not a new idea. In the early 1800s, a group of leading Americans had formed an organization for that purpose. They called it the American Colonization Society. In 1820, the society began helping to send blacks to Africa. The continuing struggle over slavery will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.